Hey, welcome to Adults, a podcast where there's always four drinks to be drunk and four topics to be ignored. This is Steve, and it's come to my attention that in previous episodes, we never really gave you a rundown of what the point of this podcast is. And since we didn't really record a cold open for this episode, I thought this might be the best shot. The basic premise of this podcast is that every week we will hit you with four segments, with topics ranging from the serious to the absurd. And while we work our way through those topics, we will also be working our way through various drinks, alcoholic drinks, and getting progressively drunker and drunker. And the topics will probably grow less and less important to us as we go. This is not a podcast where anything we say should be taken seriously or as a fact. We are often wrong, and it's more a podcast about just enjoying the weird conversations that you get into when you're having drinks at a bar. When the facts don't count and all that really matters is some combination of drunken passion and who can get off the best comeback. The podcast features a rotating cast. Usually they're a law school crew who are composed of people I met in law school, or a business school crew composed of people who I met through a friend who went to business school. Okay, let's talk about this episode. This week we've got the business school crew. That's Samsonite and Andy. Those are not their real names. They use pseudonyms, as do most of the people on this podcast, because they're worried about how it might affect their employment. Also, of note, this is the first episode we ever taped, so you're hearing it from the beginning. But this week we're drinking scotch, so if you'd like to join us, I'd recommend a nice Glenfarclas 12. And if you have any comments about things we can improve on or suggestions on things that we should discuss, please email us at adultspodcast@gmail.com or leave a comment on our website at adultspodcast.com. Without further ado, here's the show. Hey, welcome to the Adults Podcast. I'm Steve, and I'm with
Andy Whitman.
And Samsonite.
Just Samsonite, that's it.
It's like a Brazilian soccer player.
So the purpose of this podcast is to sit around with a couple friends, drink a little bit of various alcohols, and just have those kind of discussions that you have when you've been drinking too much, or maybe sometimes just a little. What do you think about that, Samsonite?
Yeah, I agree with that.
You agree with that summary of the...
That's an excellent summary. I feel like an adult, too.
That's life.
Whitman, you agree as well?
I totally agree as a white dude.
So today, for our first segment, we'll be drinking some Glenfarclas. It's a 12-year-old single malt from the Highland region of Scotland.
Steve, did you get this when you went to Scotland?
I did.
Nice.
Brought it back with me on the plane.
Can you buy it at like a BevMo, or that's like...
Yeah, which was what I should have done instead of bringing it back with me on a plane. I definitely should have just bought it at a BevMo.
Well, it's cool that you got through customs with it.
So, what do you guys think?
I think it's pretty solid. Maybe nice, my next one I'll do it neat. I have this one on the rocks.
Yeah, we're doing on the rocks for this first round. It's pretty smooth. It's a nice fruity kind of mouthfeel, right?
It's not like smoky.
Fantastic.
It's not smoky or anything.
It's not one of the smoky ones.
Yeah.
I didn't bring any smoky ones today, but if we ever do a segment in which we have to outdrink each other, I'm gonna bring a smoky one in order to have the advantage. So what are we talking about today? What's our first segment?
So the first segment, we're going to talk about the top five artists of the 90s, in your opinions. And I'm going to prompt this with a question for you guys. Are we going to segment the artists by category, or are we just going to rank them, force rank them? Because then you could say, like, number one in pop, number one in rock, number one in different categories. Or are we going to go boom?
Boom. I mean, the first one sounds a little complicated.
Yeah.
We're simple guys.
I have a little bit of genre split in mind.
Okay.
But I think we're just ranking our top five.
Okay.
And you can go, I feel like you can go back and forth between what is your personal position on a band and what you think their contributions to music as a whole have been, rather than like them being somebody you particularly like.
Yeah. That makes sense. And I think if we all are heavy rock, heavy rap, heavy whatever, we should probably make sure that we have artists from each genre that we don't lose out on.
Well, I mean, we can always talk about runners-ups, right?
That's a good
people
idea.
We think should be in the list but didn't quite make it.
Yeah,
sure.
That's good.
Yeah. So why don't you start us off? Who are you thinking about?
So I'm going to throw out a couple, and then I'm going to hear what you guys add in there. I'm not going to go through all of them. So I would definitely say the best rapper ever is Tupac, and he's of the 90s.
He's on my list.
And so I would put Tupac in there wholeheartedly.
I'd have to agree.
I moved him a little higher on my list. He'll come later for me.
I haven't ranked my five. Maybe I'll do that as we go through. We're going a little bit crazy here.
Profanity came out.
Yeah, well, this is not a, ladies and gentlemen, this is not a child safe podcast. It's not safe for work.
So, and then I would put two rock bands next.
Well, hold on, let's hear. Okay, let's do one.
Each, I think. Yeah, that's a good call.
Well, I'll go with REM.
Now note that Whiteman is looking at a best rock bands of the 90s link on his iPad.
A real bold choice there to choose what a website has told you is the best.
Were they actually 90s? I feel like they
don't believe them. I think REM, I think they're a 90s band.
I'm going to, you know what, as much as it pains me to do so, I'm going to back him 100% here. They are on my runner-up list. They almost made it to top five.
Good.
They didn't make it to your top five. That's blasphemy.
Just because I tried to go with a couple of artists who had impacts on like overall music, you know, in the following 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, if it was his personal taste, REM top five easy from the 90s.
I mean, What's the frequency, Kenneth? Did you know that's an REM song?
Yes, I did.
It's my favorite REM song.
I can have Alexa play it right now.
Well, I went with TLC.
TLC.
Wow.
Yeah.
Chase Waterfalls.
That's my first one that I think I didn't really listen to. I listened to them a little bit back in the day, but I think they had a lot of impact.
And didn't get a penis till 2000, right?
Yeah, that transition didn't take place until about 2002.
What influence or impact have they had?
Because they're great pop.
Without
fans.
TLC, there'd be no Destiny's Child, right? And with no Destiny's Child, there'd be no Beyonce.
So is that a good thing or a bad thing?
Yeah. Either way, whether that is a good thing or a bad thing, it has had impacts downline, I would say.
Okay.
So that's why I think they're influential.
I like that. I like that.
Hmm.
Plus, the pop plus a little bit of the rap.
Yeah, yeah.
It's nice.
Yeah, no, I like that. So my next one would be Nirvana.
I knew it. I knew one of you.
That's everyone's top one.
Now,
I mean, here. Of the 90s. Oh, that's the top one on the list. I mean, Nirvana, come on. Like, and it's also...
They defined the 90s.
They were grunge rock. They started grunge rock. Foo Fighters, Foo Fighters might be on people's list, but they wouldn't exist if it wasn't for Nirvana. And there was a very symbolic moment when they knocked off... Smells Like Teen Spirit knocked off Michael Jackson. I forgot which one. One of the songs from that shitty History album knocked it
black
off.
Black or
I
White feel like, or something?
Which was one? It maybe Black or White. Yeah, maybe not have been History. Hmm. But, like, they started the 90s. They started rock, grunge rock, and they brought, like, rock into the mainstream when it was more of, like, an outside influence.
First off, they did not start off grunge rock. So I'm going to buck the trend.
Ramones? Are we punk or grunge?
Were plenty of grunge bands. Prior to
but they like Mookie, brought grunge into the mainstream.
What were they? Mookie Blaylock. There was
Mookie Blaylock.
Yeah,
like the player.
Yeah, yeah. I think you're right. I think the band was actually named after the player.
Yeah, yeah. And what was the name of the Chris Cornell? Pearl
Soundgarden Jam? Was after. Oh, your Temple of the Dog.
Temple of the Dog. Mm. I think that was pre-Nirvana.
Could be, but come on, like Nirvana was what made it.
You know what? I understand. I understand what you're saying. I just have a personal thing against Nirvana because everybody always ranks them as number one of the
90s. Right. Their consensus probably number one of the 90s, like Michael Jordan.
Yeah. And when you see who my number one is, you'll understand why I hate the fact that they're ranked number one so much.
Is your number one Salt and Pepper?
Yeah, obviously.
Your number one involves an element from the ocean and something you might find in a refrigerator. Is there a good chance? It's possible.
It's possible.
All right, let's go, Whitman.
So the second on my list would be...
Your list?
He didn't go for number one on the list, so now he's just looking at his reference.
I'm just looking at the possibilities.
That's fair.
So the second one on my list would be No Doubt.
Okay.
That's a good choice.
Orange County band with an Indian presence in it, Tony Kanal.
That's,
an inspiration for all brownies.
Here's my beef with No Doubt, who I love. I enjoy No Doubt.
Beef, pun intended, or?
Here's my gluten-free tofu about No Doubt. Is the whole ska movement, I felt like ruined rock for a while. And they brought in ska, and I just didn't dig ska. Like Mighty Mighty Boss Tones.
I love Mighty Mighty Boss Tones.
That kind of shit.
Are they on your list?
No. I mean, it was just like shitty rock. Like, I felt like they just...
But most rock is.
Most rock is shitty?
Yeah, when you really break it down, I feel like most...
Even though your number one band is a rock band?
No, I'm not saying rock is special in that way. I think most music is shitty when you really break it down. There's very few like standout poets when it comes to music, right? There's very few
Would you say Bob Dylan was a poet?
Yeah. Yeah, I'd say Bob Dylan was a poet. I'd even say Bruce Springsteen was definitely a poet.
My band is actually 90s. I'm going to make sure you... But you're, what's your next... You already said that
one. I already said No Doubt, and I had No Doubt about it.
Mm-hmm. So. So good, this band is 90s. So I'm going to go with Sublime.
Okay. I'm sensing a theme.
I'm definitely more of a rock guy, although I'm tempted to throw another... Like, I feel, when you go through all the rap artists, like, I'm tempted to put Biggie in there, but I don't feel he's nearly as good as Pac. But Biggie's still up there.
I mean, to tell you the truth, I actually put the two together. Because yeah. without Biggie, you know, Tupac and Biggie are
forever
irreparably.
Linked. Yeah. I mean, maybe Biggie might be there. But what I'd say about Sublime is they had a lot of their 40 Ounce of Freedom and their Sublime album. I mean, they were short-lived, but they were just, I think, a phenomenal band at the time. They had that whole California hip hop meets rock kind of vibe to them, and they were uniquely 90s, and they, I don't know if they had like an influence much past the 90s, but I thought they were really cool then.
Do you think they had an influence on Rage Against the Machine, or were they contemporary?
I don't know. I think Rage was probably more late 90s, right?
Yeah,
I think their first
remember.
So I don't know if Sublime really drove Rage, cuz Sublime wasn't like super. I think there is the combination of rock and rap, and you have Korn and Limp Bizkit, and you have all those bands that kind of came after them. I don't know if Sublime drove that. I think they kind of had their own thing.
Yeah,
I don't know.
They were just part of it.
Yeah.
That's fair. So anyway, I'm sensing a theme. Do all of the artists on your list involve somebody in the band having
been dead?
Yeah.
No. My next band will not be dead.
Okay.
My next band is still performing.
I'm excited to hear about that.
Damn.
I may live to regret this. I'm sure you guys are going to give me crap about it. Garth Brooks.
Say what?
Is Garth Brooks because you like him or Impact?
You know, I liked him when I was a kid.
Well,
the 90s.
Really?
What was his alter ego, Chris Gaines?
Chris Gaines, right? I was out of him by that point. I had moved on to rock and roll.
Whitman, sure. If you're not familiar, Chris Gaines was Garth Brooks' alternative ego.
Yeah.
Like Marshall Mathers.
He wanted to be a little bit more edgy, right? That was his thing?
Yeah.
He wanted to be a little bit more edgy, so he created Chris Gaines to be his pseudonym, as if no one would recognize him.
Now, did you throw this out to be controversial, or did you really...
No, I'm telling you.
See him in your top five.
I probably listened to No Fences and Rope in the Wind, his two of his big albums, so much that the tapes wore out. I really liked him when I was a kid.
Now, is that a San Bernardino thing? Or
I think it's probably like a white parents thing that didn't hurt. And then...
And was he good? Would you say he was like not overrated? Because I've never heard any of his music.
Well, I think, first of all, he had a big influence.
Sure.
You know, he moved country in a certain direction. I don't listen to country at all anymore, so I don't know what direction that is. But I'm pretty sure he moved it in that direction.
No, I don't think Shania Twain, Taylor Swift would exist now.
Yeah.
Would be without him, because he made country in the mainstream.
Yeah, it's more, he brought in a more poppy feel to country, right? That you know, didn't exist with your Conway Twitties or your Merle Haggards. Who now, if I were to listen to country, that's who I would listen to. Those old school country people. Because they have some pretty decent songs.
Right.
But I don't listen to Garth Brooks anymore. So I will say that.
I listened to some George Strait when I was in Texas. He was really big in San Antonio.
Yeah.
It was kind of fun.
Yeah.
So my next one, I would put Tool. Fully Alive. Still, they haven't performed for a while, but...
So are you ranking them at this point?
No, I'm not.
Are you saying Tool is your number two?
No. Because there'll be a whole bunch. Tool and B. I think these five are going to be difficult to rank.
Okay.
But I just think about how many hours, like, I just had Tool on my old Panasonic boombox playing through that Enema CD until it, like, wore bare. I think Tool's legacy speaks for itself, even with their Perfect Circle with Maynard side groups and all that other stuff that he's doing, still being very relevant. So I think Tool, in terms of how they brought in a more kind of...
Do they have the industrial sound?
Yeah, that's
kind of
exactly.
Like Nine Inch Nails?
Yeah, and so Nine Inch Nails is probably going to just miss my list, but they had like an industrial kind of vibe. I feel like they're more melodic, like especially with Maynard's voice. Which is probably similar to like a Sublime impact there in terms of Sublime's genre. But yeah, I think just Tool has to be high on my list.
Well, you're a Tool, so it makes sense.
I'm not wearing my Tool t-shirt right now.
They are in the front page, like of the top bands of the 90s. Wow. They're the last one.
So does that mean they're the best or they're the worst?
Probably the worst.
I would agree. What do you got?
So I'll go with a band that's ranked a little bit higher on this page, and that's a classic band called the Goo Goo Dolls.
Oh, shut up. No, really?
Well,
oh, God.
My wife's favorite band from really? The 80s. Yeah.
Are you serious? And she married you, so she has good taste, yeah, clearly. So. Well, what I like about them is they have this one song. I've only heard one of their songs. It's called Iris.
Oh, my God.
But I used to play it, like, all the time because it really hit me.
So you're basing this off of one song?
Yes, because that's how profound that song was.
That's fair.
That song is shit.
So it's a very scientific... Well... But that song hits you at an emotional level.
Hits you at an emotional level if you like shit.
I mean, if it had that much of an impact on you, I recommend you go back and check out the rest of their catalog. I mean, Slide. They made a whole bunch of the same songs.
So, oh, okay. So, you know, just different names.
Like them all, yeah.
I feel like, is Nickelback on your list too?
I don't think I've ever heard them, but I just want to ask Steve. So since I like that band very much, are you in love with me now? I am Asian, technically.
The more I look across the table at you, and the more
white men is Asian. So it makes sense. So I think some bands like Axe, Artist, Biggie, Rage, Smashing Pumpkins would have been on my more extended list, but I got to put Green Day on there for my last one. I feel like, and I'm thinking what I'm comparing it to is like all these people, artists were ones that I like listened to a lot in the 90s. Mm-hmm. And Green Day, The Dookie, and then what's the one with Time of Your Life, that other album? Like both of those albums like were frequently on like my replay at home. So I think like they both had such a big impact in the 90s. And I noticed that none of us have actually gone into the boy bands or the pop bands. I think we should give it a shout out if we haven't done anything, because they had a pretty big impact.
Or the female pop singers.
Yeah, exactly. I was talking boy bands, right, the pop acts.
Oh, well, I want to say about Green Day. I used to walk home every day from school with my little cassette player listening to Dookie every single day. Yep. It was a great album. But after that, they kind of lost me.
But so they had that comeback, though, with that album. Because if it was only Dookie, I'd be like, nah. But then they had the comeback, and they really brought punk into the mainstream. Okay, well, you go ahead, Whitman.
Okay, I'll go with Soul Asylum.
And now, once again, I want to clarify, your list has no, like order to it. You're just naming five bands.
You just enjoy
it. So you're not saying Soul Asylum is your favorite band of the 1990s?
I'm naming five bands from the 90s that I remember.
Oh, okay. That's
and
fair.
Soul Asylum is one of them.
The 90s were
a very traumatic time
era for you. Okay.
But I'll go with Soul Asylum, Runaway Train. I really like that song. And I don't know if your wife likes it, too.
No.
Nimrod is the album I'm thinking of.
Okay. I remember Nimrod.
Nimrod was where they had their little comeback.
Okay. That's fair. All right. Are we done roasting him on Soul Asylum?
I don't know if he even knows Soul Asylum. Just like Runaway Train, that's what you're there for?
I remember the whole album back, but it was like so long ago.
Do you like Collective Soul, too?
That sounds familiar. Yeah, I think I like them, too.
Yeah. What about County Crows?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
I actually enjoyed County Crows.
Come on.
I put them up there.
I like County
They had
Crows,
one album.
Yeah.
It was really, and then the other albums had maybe one hit or two.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. I'm gonna bust it out. I have last say on this segment. The best band of the 1990s was Pearl Jam. That's it. Good night. Goodbye, people.
All right. I can't disagree.
Pearl Jam actually would have been on my extended list too. 10, but like after 10 and Verses, it was like,
what are you talking about?
Vitology
was a great album. No Code was a great album.
You like, was it Bugs?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm a big fan of Bugs. I still listen to it to this day. They're crawling on my skin right now.
A Pearl Jam and Nirvana, I think, would be on pretty much everyone's top five list of the 90s. So no one can disagree with Pearl Jam.
At least I feel vindicated.
No, I think Pearl Jam's... I know some people hate Pearl Jam, but I really like Pearl Jam. I'd put them up there, too.
I mean, if they hadn't committed career suicide by going against Ticketmaster, I really feel like they would have made a much larger impact.
I don't feel Ticketmaster is a problem. They always sold out their shows, right?
Yeah, but they had to go to small venues.
Oh, really?
So they basically were taking in less money because of how small the venues they were going to were. All right. Well, I think we should get another drink.
That's a good call. So, Steve, what are we drinking now?
We're going to move on to Aberlour, a little variety they call Abunar. It's a Highlands single malt out of the Speyside region.
Mm. I'm going to pour some.
Woo! It's got a little bit more kick than that last one, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does.
Whoa.
It's It's not as smooth as the, what do we have, Glenn Farkla?
Glenn Farkless? Yeah, that was our first one.
Oh, yeah.
Was this also...
this much stronger.
That one has some body to it. It burns a little, doesn't it?
So I like the B.I.G. of scotch.
Yeah, well, we're also drinking it neat this round.
Mm.
So that kind of makes it burn a little bit more.
That's true. So we're talking now about sports. And I think we have...
I want you guys to explain sports to me, just in general.
Okay.
We might be able to narrow that down a little bit, but I'm not much
you're
of a sports guy.
And I'm a big sports fan. And Whitman over here is like a medium sports fan.
I'm a big sports fan.
Yeah. So it sounds like baseball is often the most maligned sport.
I hate baseball.
But you like cricket.
Yes.
Constantly. Which is basically baseball.
Well, it came before baseball.
Oh, yeah. And then
it was the game of kings.
It's like rock ball compared to rock ball became soccer. So baseball is often the most maligned. I think there's a couple things that drive interest in baseball. One thing is one of the first organized sports kids play. So if you're a kid, you go like you're in elementary school, all your friends are playing baseball. Kids grow up playing baseball, and it's just immediately. And girls play softball, so immediately like there's a social construct that you connect with your peers with, and you connect with your parents with, because your parents are usually coaching, supporting you, taking the game. And it's often like it's a win-win, right?
Do you think that's still happening?
I think Little League is still... I mean, now you have kids probably
what about
playing...
Soccer.
Soccer, basically...
As a parent...
Rich kids send all their kids...
Soccer is huge.
No, rich kids send basically... Rich parents send their kids to play soccer and baseball. It's like the two most common sports. So you play soccer in the winter and you play baseball in the spring. That's most common.
Okay.
At least when I was growing up. And sometimes like kids play basketball. Football is a bit tougher because of the injuries. they play like Pop Warner and whatnot. So like you immediately like... And that's similar to all sports, but I think baseball, Little League in particular, is like the strongest run system, better than AYSO or these other leagues.
So your hypothesis is that these kids are basically indoctrinated into
so
enjoying baseball?
So they brought into it, right?
Because there's no other reason that anybody would enjoy baseball, right?
And then so there's another aspect of enjoying the sport itself. And that's going to be similar for a football, hockey, whatever. You're enjoying people who are performing at a level, throwing a ball faster than anybody, hitting a ball harder than anybody, all those things. And the thing that keeps me... So there's that like spectacle aspect. And that's similar for basketball. That's similar like these 7-footers doing this crazy stuff. So when you get to watch it and we watch it in person, it's very amazing. And then there's the last aspect that I think is what drives a lot of interest is like the strategy behind it. So I think that's where it gets interesting.
Okay, explain this to me because that does interest me. What is the strategy to baseball? You just hit the ball and try to
Of course the end game is to score the most runs.
Yeah.
That's the easy point, right? But then each lineup and each point, each pitch has its own situational strategy, right? So you start the game and usually like the pitcher is deciding, do I want to be aggressive? Do I want to go after this hitter? Is this a hitter that swings at a first pitch strike? Is this someone that swings low and away? The hitter will come in there and have done their own scouting, trying to figure out, is this pitcher somebody that like if I get behind him, it's going to be a problem? Is this someone that's usually typically wild that I should hold off on this first pitch? So every pitch is going to have its own strategy and every situation will have a strategy. So if a player's on first base, what you'll see sometimes at the games, it's actually really cool, is like when someone is hitting a grounder, that guy from right field is going to go run out to back up the first baseman. The catcher is going to run out and back up the third baseman. Like there's going to be all these things that happen behind the scenes that you don't really know what's going on. But there's that strategic element of it. And when you realize like every pitch matters, especially in times like the playoffs, I mean, 162 games becomes a slog. But when you're in the playoffs and every pitch matters and you realize like, oh man, how'd they miss that strike? Like this could be critical because now this guy's ahead of the count. And when this guy's ahead of the count at like, you know, 1-2, this is like a pivotal moment of the game. And so that's where I think gets really interesting, where you're actually watching like the chess pieces and the X and O's, and then you realize what manager's an idiot and what manager's a good one, and it gives you a little bit more of a background. So I think that might be where you get into, and then you get into the analytics of it, and that's where things get a lot of fun because you can debate, is this guy worth $10 million? Is this guy like, should we have traded for this? Like, this person's coming up for free agency in 2 years, right? And so we're going to have to pay him a lot more. But then, like, this person is much younger, but not as good. But then we'll have him under team control for 5 or 6 years. So then, like, the armchair GM parts, which are similar in basketball, similar in football, all these sports.
But the more strategic elements, do you think that there is more strategy to baseball than to, say, Basketball?
Yes. Well, I'd say baseball and probably football because they're more turn-based. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Because, like, you plan that strategy for that particular
play. Basketball is more fluid.
Basketball is more fluid, so that's more... Like, there is strategic elements of we need to attack the center. They've got, like, X amount of fouls, or this center is very likely to swipe, or this is, like, this lineup spaces the floor well and things like that. But I think in-game action is a little bit different, like, not as strategic in, like, a basketball... As compared to like a baseball or a football where you basically the coaches and everything will plan their turns like every turn.
I would say football to me probably is one of the most strategic games. It's almost like a military exercise sometimes. Like you have hundreds, literally hundreds of plays that your team needs to know and memorize the situation on the field. People who don't follow football just see a bunch of big guys hitting each other. But there is a tremendous amount of strategy, a tremendous amount of intellectual aspect that goes into it, especially at the quarterback position. And if you're, like a middle linebacker or something on the defense, you're the quarterback of the defense.
And I think as a coach.
As a coach, for sure. I mean, yeah. You have hundreds of plays.
And the armchair GM aspect is actually pretty fun. Like being an armchair general manager saying, oh, I would have drafted this guy, I would have traded for this guy, blah, blah, blah. Oh,
okay, so how are those theories and suppositions ever borne out in reality, though? You never actually see what would have happened if you had drafted those guys.
Well, then you could go, oh, I said we should have traded for him, and look how well they're doing now. I made that call. Okay.
The hypotheticals are what make an hour at the bar just fly. When you talk about that stuff that could have been that you can never prove.
Okay.
But I will say about sports, what I love about sports the most is I think it's as close to a meritocracy as exists on
Earth. That's true.
So you can get into Hollywood being the kid of a producer who Uncle Larry put you in his movie or whatever. You know, you can music is the same way. You know, looks really matter. Connections really matter. But in sports, I mean, Steph Curry's on the team not because he's Del Curry's son. It's because he's pretty damn good at what he does. I mean, he's no Kawhi Leonard, but he's decent.
So, what about someone Luke Walton?
Yeah, so Luke Walton got his position not because he was Bill Walton's son necessarily. And the fact that his career didn't go on very long proves it's a meritocracy,
but
right?
Let's pause. Like, even we will make fun of Luke Walton, but he played for, what, 8-9 years in the NBA at the highest level. Yeah. I mean, he wasn't a great player by any means.
Right.
He probably
Is he a good coach now?
It remains to be seen.
Okay. So did he get that coaching job, you think, because
of I think his coaching might be a little bit different in some ways than playing.
So it's a meritocracy on the court.
On the court. But, yeah, because off the court, you know, it's a business off the court.
But if he fails as a coach, because right now he's got put on a horrible team, they're giving him the benefit of the doubt. But let's say in 2 years from now, if his team doesn't perform, they'll fire him. It doesn't matter. Yeah. Like, he needs to get wins. That's the end result.
Right. In Hollywood, like, you don't get fired from a movie because someone says your acting was horrible. It's because you are just unpredictable. You don't show up on time or you're a diva. But it's not really based, like, I think in these kind of professions, you got to perform or you're out. And in other businesses, the performance is more about showing up and being, you know, you obviously quality matters. But there's certain positions where you don't have to produce quality. You just have to be there.
There's something about watching the people who are the best in the world at a particular craft competing against others who are the best in the world and trying to, and then you see what happens, how that unfolds. Like, there's no better drama than that.
Yeah,
but I do definitely agree with Whitman here. Like, the whole meritocracy, like, you have to perform. Like, being Luke Walton was great for him. Maybe he was born with certain advantages that he didn't have to, like, fight to make time to practice on the basketball court, and he had certain genetic gifts that other people probably didn't have, but he still had to perform. I mean, he was still, like, the highest rated recruit coming out of high school, right? There's a reason for that. Okay. Like, he was good.
Yeah. Right. Well, you know, I still will not be watching any sports, but you guys have convinced
me. There is a social aspect of it, too. There is
don't care.
You connect with people so you can talk about it. You can go watch the games, like, and have... I think even if you're just, like, a baseline, like, I just like to go to a baseball game and eat a hot dog and when the weather's nice.
Right.
There's, like, different levels of depth of sports fandom.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful, innocent kind of pleasure, almost childlike, like the love for sports to me. It's like Samsonite said, you know, it's a great uniter. You can sit next to someone on a plane and totally connect with someone in a few minutes if it turns out that you have something in common, like the team that you like.
Yeah, I can see that.
Or even if you just follow the same sport and they're wearing a Cowboys hat and you're a Niners fan, you could talk like, oh, you guys had a great year. Oh, man, I used to hate your guys. Like, you can always connect about
that. And I'll say one more thing about sports is I think it's a great parable for life in many ways. And that's what I think maybe someone like you could really appreciate, perhaps. Like, like, so I love the Spurs, right? But the Spurs, to me, are like a model of consistency. And if you see, it's almost like a business empire that's been going on and on and on for years and years and years. And so if you look at the life cycle of businesses, you know, starting up, maturing, declining, the Spurs have kept their consistency over time. And I think that's a great business parable in many ways. How do you do that? How do you decide, you know, how do you pick the next generation? How do you look forward many years to say, okay, in 5 years, we need to have this in order to keep going. Mm-hmm. So I think that's very underappreciated.
Sports. Is that a product of just investment, though, from being like an established franchise that has done well for long
Spurs,
enough?
Like most teams, like the Spurs and the Patriots in football, I think are the two.
Right.
That it's very rare that you have like consistent excellence over a long period of time, like those two franchises. And I think it's just a well-run, well-run business. Now,
so you don't agree with the people who say that the Patriots have just bought their...
No, because absolutely there's a salary cap.
Yeah, absolutely not.
The Patriots, you could argue, haven't proven it long enough because all they've won is with Tom Brady.
And Bill Belichick.
And Belichick, who have been paired together. Right. So when Tom Brady retires, then it remains to be seen if they'll continue to be excellent. The Spurs did go through...
Robinson.
Duncan. Yeah, but Robinson wasn't... Like they
won the first championship when Duncan... It was Duncan's rookie year, I think, or
and
second
And now
year.
They've gone through a second phase where they're still excellent without Duncan, which right. is very rare when you move from... It's like almost...
Right.
You pass
and remains to be seen with the Patriots. But if Belichick's still there, I would wager that they'll still be good.
Yeah. Okay. What, so then what makes you have disdain for sports? Because you play in our fantasy leagues. You do know sports to some extent.
I wouldn't say I have disdain for sports. I just don't care about it. It's just not one of the things that I would sink time into other than just the minimal amount of time to, you know, set up my fantasy team.
What if Whitman and I say, hey, let's go catch a Dodgers game?
Oh, yeah, I'd go.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I don't...
But the thing is while I'm there, one of the chief things in the back of my mind would be how early do I have to leave here to beat people out of the parking lot? Not necessarily what are the strategies that these teams are employing against one another.
Would you care if it's a close game at the end and, like, you know, everyone's, like, jumping up and down?
When I watch a game, I enjoy it.
Yeah. So you make it sound like you're like anti sports, but I think you're just not super into it.
I'm just trying to be an asshole for the podcast.
And then sports, right? Today, right? Like where everything is recorded and DVR'd. Sports is one of the few live things, right, that people can share.
Yeah. What do you think of people who like record their sports, but yet still are like, I don't want to hear anything about this sport.
No, I mean, you have to turn your phone off if you're doing that.
Yeah.
Okay.
You have to get offline if you're going to be
so
like...
So no spoilers. You're a no spoilers sports fan?
No.
I guess there is no point in watching a sport if you know
I mean, if you really enjoyed that game and you're a fan of that team, you can rewatch a game. But at the end of the day, like, you need to watch the sport live or live to you and not know what happened.
Okay. In order to enjoy it.
And that gives something you maybe until from that evening.
The unpredictability, right, of it. Like, and, you know, because hearing someone won is very different from watching the way they came back from, like, 20 points down or, like, the Patriots in the Super Bowl, right? If you didn't, like, imagine, I don't know if you watched the Super Bowl or not, but the Patriots coming back from that insane, you know, margin.
I actually beat the traffic home instead of watching the end of that Super Bowl game.
Oh, man. So, I mean, that's just something, that's the beauty of sports, the unpredictability.
No, yeah,
it's beautiful.
Okay.
It's I think the best unscripted drama you could get.
Yeah.
All right. Well, on that note, I think I'm ready for another drink.
Let's do it.
Sounds good.
Up that we take from here, they try to stop the plant. Marijuana butterflies, I witness in a thousand eyes. Thousand songs that I wrote for you, but you ain't hear them, so here we go. Moving as a troop, bet they won't hear us, so if they do, fuck it, swing the blade until we kill them all. Back in February, throwing baseball, blue tunes as we approach another world. Hydration from the water boy, but don't you sleep. He might be the one to sneak up on you, then go drop the heat. Every time they try to pay me, best believe I kept it G. Solo dolo, young samurai chopping slow though, beat it slow though. Let her take it, pick and use that shit for promo. Let me know, no, still taking my chances every time.
All right, what are we drinking, Mr. Whitman?
So right now we're having a Glenlivet 18, one of the smoothest scotches on earth.
Well, let's see if that stands up.
Where's yours?
I'll drink some of yours. I'm still enjoying the... what was the last one?
Still working your way through the Abunar?
Abunar. I want to still be coherent.
That's fair. I'm not too worried about being coherent by the end of this.
This is a beautiful scotch.
Oh, man, this is good.
It's very smooth.
Yeah.
Really smooth.
It's beautiful.
It's not smoky or peaty, though.
No.
It doesn't have that.
I didn't bring any smoky or peaty ones tonight.
Well, I didn't know if Whitman had some. Do you have any ones?
This is Whitman's.
I know, but I'm wondering if you have, like, a smoky...
No, that's all I have. I have another Glen.
I have a Talisker. Talisker, I like that one.
Big fan of Talisker. Big fan of Lafroig.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Those will be my two go-tos often.
So you like the smoky whiskeys?
Yeah, I do.
Well, you know, maybe one episode we'll do a smoky whiskey tasting.
Yeah. I feel like it has character. I like the smooth ones. The second one I could have gone without.
It was a little harsh. That's a question that I was going to ask. Do you think we should be rating these as we drink them?
I don't know. I feel like anytime you try and rate whiskeys, it's so...
Listeners, let us know what you think.
Yeah. Yeah.
Should we be rating our whiskeys? Or
Mom, let me know what you think.
All right, so our next topic is a little segment I like to call Hold My Beer, where we dream of the implications of various article titles, and then eventually maybe we learn that reality isn't quite what it turns out to look like. So our article today is Boom Supersonic Jet Able to Fly to London from London to New York in 3 hours is a step closer to production. So, you know, 3 hour flight from London, New York.
What's that now? Six, like an American Airlines flight, 6 hours?
Yeah, it cuts in half. From Los Angeles to London, that'd be 6 hours, right?
That'd be longer, I think.
I think
from LA to London might be 8 or 9, I think.
No, I mean, in this jet.
Oh, yeah.
In 6 hours.
So LA to New York would be 3 hours as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you can, and then like from LA to, well, I guess it's best for long hauls, because if you go to like Seattle, it's just
we would
still have to get up to,
I mean, most of your time in going to Seattle is just getting into the plane and getting off of the plane, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that reminds me of the Concorde. We already had something that flew in that speed. The Concorde flew from London to New York in 3.5 hours.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
it was beautiful.
Yeah, it was a model of engineering, right?
Yeah, it was. Yeah. And Airbus claimed that their next Concorde would do it in 1.5 hours. Unfortunately, we never saw a lot of innovation in transportation.
What was the reason? So clearly, like, it was too expensive. Was the reason that it used too much gas?
Well, I think the reason why the Concorde died was, one, obviously the cost.
What was the cost? Was the cost of the plane was too expensive? Was it to run it was too expensive? Operationally, gas, it used up way much oil?
Well, the Concorde was a one-off, so I assume that the production costs, they were trying to recover a lot of production costs right off the bat with that.
Right.
So that drove up ticket prices, right?
Okay. And then
I think there is also a lot more fuel consumption for those faster moving.
You say there's a one-off. There's only one Concorde?
I think there was only one Concorde, right?
Well, I think there were like a few different routes, like 3 different routes and like 15 to 20 planes total.
Were there not
enough for...
It's the same one model.
For some reason, in my mind, I'd always thought that there was just one Concorde. Okay, that's interesting.
Yeah, because it was around, like, it kind of, we never took it, right? So we didn't really know much about it, I think.
So this is the harsh reality of this title, right? That eventually, we could already do 3 hour flights to London.
Right.
But the price is prohibitive. They just can't sell the tickets.
And I think on the Concorde, there was a little bit of bad luck, too. They had a flight that crashed, killing everyone on board.
Yeah.
That was bad publicity, right? You only have a few planes and one of them crashes and everyone dies. It was like an Air France flight.
Yeah, I just wonder if the drive is to get cheaper or low. Like, is that the whole goal? Like, to get, they want lighter planes because it uses less gas and everything is just focused on getting cheaper, like cheaper materials? Or is there a goal does any airline say, we really want to make these flights faster? Because I feel like that's probably one of the big also implications of the problem, that no airline is really motivated to make things faster. Like, well, it's fast enough. You can get to London in 6 hours from New York. Why would we try and even do it faster?
Well, the weird thing is, like, if you look at some of these business class prices, right? Like, a business class flight from LA to New York can be like $5,000. You know,
not,
sometimes.
But
it can be. And that's what my companies have been charged in the past. Like, I've looked at ticket prices, they're $4,000 to go from LA to New York.
Yeah,
on United Business,
less,
for example. And then I just wonder, like, if you can price something at about a business class price, right, from LA to New York, let's say a few grand, so why wouldn't companies do that?
Just do business class. It's basically like higher level service. You might only have like 40 seats on a plane.
Right. It's better than NetJets. It's bigger than a charter flight. but it's not like full commercial. Or maybe you have two sections. I don't know how you split it out. You have to work out the pricing. But why couldn't something like that work today? Because we live in the Gilded Age.
Yeah.
You know, we're in the average house in L.A. is $1 million, and it's
go to the Bay Area. Some crappy house will be like $4 million.
Right. Exactly. So why can't we do that?
Well, you guys fly a lot. I don't fly a whole lot. I mean, are first class sections of planes filled out?
Invariably. But sometimes you don't know if they're filled out because they had capacity and they're upgrading someone, bumping someone up. Yeah.
A lot of times people get bumped or people are booking flights. It depends. Like, you know, and then you have differences between like procurement departments, or it's different rules of you can fly first class if you're like a salesperson and you do so much. Right. Or some companies just let people fly first class, and some, you know, I think a lot of times they do get booked because they're not price sensitive, but there's usually sometimes like an upgrade of like, you know, somebody who flies a whole hell of a lot.
And a whole lot of those people are upgrading using things like miles and things like that. So if it's an airline that just focuses on these, you know, expensive trips.
Well, sometimes it's a free upgrade, like. You know, they just have the seats up full, and then they paid for an economy ticket, but they got bumped.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is if your plane is all first class, then there's nobody to upgrade from.
Yeah, correct.
So, so like, if you're not selling out that entire plane, your first class seats.
I'd imagine most seats are first class. Like, most seats are actually paid for.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
I would say like a majority of the first class seats are paid for. I mean, I've flown business class because if you're on a long haul or whatnot, and you see a bunch of your coworkers or similar type of people, like, oh, I'm clear that I know they're in the same profession. And so I'd say that there'd be a good percentage in first class. And so it's just depends on the demand for first class tickets, business class type tickets for those kind of routes. I think I don't think it's not doable. I think it's more of a matter of airlines run on such awful margins right now that it's just really tough for them to like offer that, like make that risk, because it's a risk that they have to take to buy these planes that can do this.
Well, I think it's just a matter of innovation, right? Like if we have an Elon Musk character who puts his mind to it, something like this, you know, I think is low-hanging fruit. If you're talking about hyperloops, you're talking about space travel, like I think this problem is probably too beneath him. It's probably too small for him.
Elon Musk will show up on Mount Rushmore of innovators because he got to Mars or because he made an electric car.
Exactly.
If he makes a flight that's normally 5 hours, 4 hours, everyone's gonna be like, oh, cool work, and he's gonna make a lot of money, but he's not gonna be like some
It's a little bit below him. Maybe he can delegate it to his cousin or something.
Stefan Musk.
Lenny Musk.
Well, his cousin runs Solar City. They're probably going bankrupt soon, so...
No, I thought Musk bought Solar City, too.
Yeah, I think he's bought it to scale out his cousin. He's got free time. Yeah. Cousin Musk.
Yeah, there we go.
Have him do it.
Old Larry Musk will...
I think we've solved this problem, gentlemen. So why don't we move on to the next drink?
Okay.
All right.
So what are we drinking right now, Steve?
We've got an Ardbeg. It's an Islay single malt scotch from the beautiful island of Islay, where I have visited. It's a 10-year-old. It's more of a smoky.
I like this.
Samsonite, you were talking about earlier how you wanted a more smoky whiskey. So I dug into my bag and found this one.
It's wonderful.
Your backpack of scotch.
Yeah. I like it. It's very smooth, but it's got that peatiness to it.
Excellent. So, Whitman, what's our segment?
So, our segment is how do you pick a good investment, or what makes a good investment? So
you know, I feel like maybe we should get into at this point your qualifications. You can be kind of obscure about them.
Newsflash, he's not qualified.
But you work in the investment community, correct?
I work in the investment business. I'm not a registered investment advisor.
Okay.
So all disclaimers apply. I think I know a little bit about investing in finance, but I'm just a drunk guy talking to two other drunk guys.
And that's all that matters. So listeners, just take our advice with a grain of salt is what I'm saying.
Absolutely.
But, you know, we're just shooting the shit.
Okay.
Now, when we say investment, though, like, are we talking about just like a stock, a bond, like a financial instrument? Are we talking about like... If you have $50,000 or $5, what do you do with it?
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, first, I think investment is really broad, right? I think almost everything in life is an investment. Our time right now is an investment.
Mm-hmm.
Some would say that this is a bad investment.
We did drink a lot of scotch.
Yeah, we got some good scotch.
That's fair.
So our time is an investment. You know, picking a spouse is an investment, picking a car. A car is also kind of an investment, maybe a depreciating one. But if you're talking about investments, as Samsonite was asking, you know,
picking your friends is a big investment.
Picking your friends.
Oh, I failed in that.
our investment in business school was an investment. Okay. And for some people, it's probably paying off. And for some people, they may not be seeing the return on that investment.
Or undergraduate degree or anything.
I personally invested in law school. And once again, I just am par for the course. I'm making bad investments. So
but your MBA investment had very little monetary cost.
That's true. My wife did the MBA. So absolutely. I kind of capitalized on that.
Absolutely. And you're getting a good return long term, too. It's like an annuity.
Yeah.
And that's typically any education investment is that. Right. So it's not, you're not going to get the money in year one,
right.
Especially an MBA.
Right.
Especially if you do full time, because being in the part time program, you're still earning income.
Opportunity
so you're
cost.
Still, you know, let's say you drop down after taxes 70K right. or something like that. Yeah, you probably didn't get 70K more in year one.
Right.
But absolutely. If you can get 5K every year, then you easily got that.
Absolutely.
Or if you just got to a more rewarding career that you wouldn't have been able to do otherwise, maybe it's less of a monetary,
right,
but more of a...
And there could be an implicit, you may not even know that it helped you, right? There might be an implicit advantage to doing it that may not be absolutely clear up front. You know, I may have gotten my last job with the MBA helping and not even known that that was why.
Yeah, that was on your resume. You didn't know that they actually picked you for that.
Absolutely.
Or some LinkedIn recruiter saw it and said, hey, that person would be
exactly.
Right.
So in general, I think, you know, an investment is a very broad term, as we just talked about.
Sure.
So what makes a good investment? I mean, I think good investment is where you make what you deem to be an acceptable return, given the amount of risk that you're prepared to tolerate.
Mm-hmm.
Right, so that's a very broad way of putting it. And then what are some of the things you can invest in? Of course, the first thing we all think of is a stock, right? Is a stock a good investment?
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the investment field is really broad. There are different types of investment instruments.
Maybe because I think you're getting in a very good category. There's one good category of purely financial investments. So that's going to go stocks, bonds. I wouldn't even put real estate there. That's a different category. But one's just like you put money into it and you get money out. Like there's no actual impact, right?
Right.
I mean, if you're a shareholder of Microsoft, that doesn't give you
any
access.
You have no
control. Yeah, it doesn't matter, right?
Yeah.
So there's one like being a bondholder, stockholder, there's a lot of choices. Then there's probably more like, I'd say, monetarily impacted, like a real estate where it's very much an event or an automobile or whatever. Like that's very much. And then there's other ones like
private investments. Private investments, investing in businesses.
Businesses, maybe I'd put that in the last category.
Okay.
And then I'd put a different category of more personal, like investing in your education, investing in your marriage, you know, investing in relationships, investing in your well-being. So like, I think those all are on their own plank. Like, if you want to invest in education, that's probably one of the best investments you can make.
Right.
Save, you know, for particular, do your due diligence there.
Right.
And then, of course, investing in those other two, I think, is where you're getting at, right?
Right. And I think the cool thing is that in all of these, the principles are kind of broadly the same, you know, because they're all, whatever you're investing in, whether it's financial, non-financial, you still have you should have some kind of process into it. Like when you're picking a mate, for example, it can't just be all emotional, as, you know, probably some of us know, you know, it's, because anything that you do for the long haul is something that requires some kind of checklist or some kind of thought process.
Yeah. So how do you apply those thought processes that you apply to picking a mate to picking a stock?
So, you know,
that is a sexy stock.
So Steve just asked me for a hot stock tip.
Give me a hot stock tip.
Well, I have none, but what I will say is, you know, in general, like there's
something you can live with a year down the line.
Yeah. So I think the first thing I've learned is, like, for example, in financial instruments, there's a million ways to make money and there's a million ways to lose money.
Mm-hmm.
The approach that works for me may not work for everyone else, but like some of the common approaches I'll just go through like really quickly. But one is, for example, like the Warren Buffett approach. You pick only a few stocks. You treat them as if you're buying a business, not a stock. So if I'm buying a share of an airline,
because he buys enough share of that business and he can actually run it.
He's big enough now where he's actually running these businesses. He controls them, which we can't do as minority shareholders, for example. But one is that approach, like a long term, buy only a few stocks, but buy them as if you own the business, not just like a piece of paper with a symbol on it. Like,
is Warren Buffett a great stock picker, or is he a great operational mind that knows how to run businesses successfully?
Well, he had to come from somewhere, right? He started out as a great stock picker, right?
Yeah,
and now he's developed into a guy who can
help a business. Yeah, I think most people would probably say he's more of the former, like a stock picker, because in terms of operations, he usually acquires these companies and he leaves the top management in place, and they continue running the business as they did before, pretty much, with just an occasional kind of up-to-date to him. Of course, keeping all these businesses in harmonies is not easy, so obviously he's a very talented operator too, but
his big holdings, like Geico and like Coca-Cola.
Well, he chooses businesses that he thinks just need an influx of capital in order to basically capitalize on something that they already have going, right?
Right, absolutely.
You and I can't do.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Recently, he's been going more like, you know, some of the great investments he's made, like their books on that. But like, for example, investing in Goldman Sachs during the depths of the Depression was a fantastic investment. Goldman Sachs, Bank of America. Recently, he's bought stakes in some airlines.
Was that a fantastic investment because of his investment or because they were ultimately bailed out?
Yeah, I think when he made his investment, I think he took that into account, the probability of their being bailed out, because even his investment probably would not have been enough to bail them out. But I think he's not Uncle Warren who just sits and drinks Cherry Coke and you know, cracks jokes, you know, with a fire. He's a shrewd operator.
Yeah.
He's not a folksy old guy who just happened to make money. He's a really shrewd guy.
Yeah. So, my point is that in that case, he was betting on a political issue.
Clearly.
Yeah. He was betting on the politics of it.
Clearly, he thought there was a very high probability that these big investment banks, or specifically Goldman, would be bailed out, and they were literally too big to fail, and it was borne out by the results.
Yeah, good
and
bet.
And just one thing I'd say there is what I think is important also is to separate process and outcome. So, you know, you can if you have a specific process for picking an investment and it doesn't work out, that's okay, because you can refine your process, see where you went wrong. But if you have a bad process and you have a good outcome, that's the worst thing that can happen to you.
Because you get stuck in a rut, right?
Well, you think you're good.
Yeah.
You might have a really sloppy way of doing stuff, and somehow you got bailed out. And you thought, oh, I'm a genius. You know, like, they worked out for me. And because it worked out, my thought process was perfect. And those are the people who kind of, it's like betting on black and roulette. You think you're a genius the first two times it happens, and you keep getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and then, you know, you lose everything. So the longer you stay in the game, the more important it is to have a good process than to have necessarily good outcomes. Because if you have a good process, you should have a good outcome long term.
Okay. Do you think most stocks, like outside of like index funds and things like that, like any person even sitting at this table, or maybe even less astute, like, and I don't know anything, so I want to be clear about that, but like, would actually be able to know enough about a stock better than what's been publicly traded? Because there's, you know, there's a lot of information out there, and people who are actually making the big bets, the mutual funds, the institutional investors, they're going to know way more than us.
Yeah. Can you dive into financial statements deep enough to learn something that
that
the market hasn't already adjusted for?
Yeah, I think it's very difficult for most people. I think it's, you know, there's too many smart people in the game. You know, over the last 20, 30 years, over the last generation, since Michael Lewis wrote Liar's Poker, pretty much, a lot of the sharpest minds in the world have gone into money shuffling, aka finance.
Yeah.
And so it's a loser's game. It's very, very difficult for most people to beat these professionals long term. It is possible to beat them, but I don't think it's necessarily through delving through financial statements very deeply, where I think it's still possible to do that. But I think it's by taking into account the constraints that these investors have. So if I'm a big institutional investor, right, what are my constraints? I got to keep publishing my results every week or every month or every quarter, at most, every quarter. So one advantage I have is I have a long-term time horizon. So I can buy something that's noisy right now or hated right now and hold it for the long term. Whereas if some Mr. Big Shot, finance MBA Wall Street guy, buys a certain stock and it has some bad headlines, he's going to be questioned, hey, why did you buy the stock? It's down 40%. And it's like that headline noise that people don't like. And they run away from situations where there's hair on the dog.
It's like the Big Short, where Christian Bale's character was just getting hammered and then he ended up getting the biggest returns. And Michael Burry.
Michael Burry. Burry, yeah. So Michael Burry is a great story. Like, he got hammered because his investors were like, we thought we were buying into this type of investor and you turned into this type of investor, and they redeemed all of his funds. So that's the problem, is these days it's very hard to have someone whose capital is locked up. The day you have a bad quarter or a bad year, you know, people are bailing out. And at the time when you should be investing, you're actually trying to sell stuff to meet redemptions from investors. So I would say for most of us, the biggest advantage we have is time arbitrage, which is that we can think long term. Mm-hmm. Whereas other people, while they're smart enough to think long term, they don't have the luxury of being able to do that.
Bree's investing like water, I think. I've heard like a lot of water related
investments. I've heard that too. Yeah. Yes. Well, he's private, so it's very hard to tell what he's doing. But yeah, water is a very good long term theme.
It's also kind of scary. Yeah. But it makes sense.
Yeah, there's a lot of talk about water wars in the future and you know, water being a good long term theme.
All right. Well, so what do you think about this as an investment strategy? I've never put any actual money into it because I put my money in a mutual fund. I don't have time for this shit. But if, you know, if I had a bunch of money sitting around, I've always noticed that certain stocks, you know, after there's some kind of disaster or something, they'll plummet and then they'll inevitably regain. So take 9/11 airports, airline stocks, you know, plummeted and then they rebounded. So is there a disaster tourism of investing?
That's a really good question. That's a tough one to tell. I think in some cases there is, for example, Japanese stocks after Fukushima or airline stocks. But the problem is sometimes you have to know the industry too, because some industries can be so leveraged that they'll bounce back. Exactly.
And I'll give an example. Like when Trump was elected, some people thought, because when Brexit happened, like the pound dropped.
Right.
And so when Trump was elected, people were like, he's going to be very isolationist and stocks are going to drop. So some people shorted the market and lost a lot of money because the stocks actually
The opposite happened.
I'm more talking about after you've seen an actual drop as the result of something like 9/11. Like the next day, airline stocks drop.
So if you bought a
portfolio of every airline,
then
wouldn't you kind of spread out your risk?
You're saying after they drop, invest.
Yes,
because disaster investing.
Because then airline industry is going to rebound as a whole.
Right.
Some airlines might not make it, but some will.
I think it's a good strategy, but you need to, just a couple of things is you need to do it like long term over different industries, because sometimes you can still lose. Mm-hmm. So you got to size your position properly, because for example, investing in the airline industry after 9/11,
saying I have to diversify my portfolio, because that's just crazy.
I'm kind of saying that, but what I'm saying is that the bet can't be too big where it kills you.
Because even that airline example,
like
airlines struggled for a few years because 9/11 almost, and I don't, it's timed around the same time as a recession, like especially in the .com market. And so airlines, even not because of 9/11, but because there's a recession, people are driving more.
Right.
It stayed down. So it was like, there was actually 9/11 hit, people, you know, the airline stocks dropped. And so it's like, it's tough to predict. And maybe airlines would have gone out. Maybe.
Yeah. Imagine if the shoe bomber had been successful or there'd been two more attacks. So don't confuse outcome and process for everything. So don't make big bets.
Okay. Well, you've talked me out of it. I'll never invest.
No, that's a great question though, because I think you can do that. If you do that investing, but you have to do it like in manageable chunks and you got to do it across industries and over time. And I think you'll probably do pretty well if you did that. But buy baskets. Don't bet on individual players.
Yeah.
Buy a basket because then keep in mind that some industries can go bankrupt too. Airlines are very leveraged industry. Is a very leveraged industry.
Who said that? Was it Warren Buffett or no, it was Richard Branson who said the quickest way to become a millionaire is to be a billionaire and buy an airline. Right.
Exactly.
that particular industry.
Yeah. That industry hasn't returned much value. But it's ironic now that Warren Buffett just announced a few months ago that he was a huge investor in a few airlines like Delta and United, I think.
And I think what we're talking about is like parameters for probably the first category of investing, where we're talking about like financial instruments, which you have very little personal. For the last two, one thing I'll add, like where you're talking about like maybe real estate, which is still or personal investing in a company where there's still some skin in the game where you're involved in it, or just investing in education, investing in investing with friendships or whatnot. What I've started to see sometimes in like even businesses to some extent is like people aren't using like ROI in purely dollar sense, but they're using outcome based like metrics. Like, and it's tough to say that when you're talking about like real estate or something like that, but you say, all right, how much do I value my own happiness? Like, how much do I value having a commute that's like 15 minutes shorter?
Absolutely.
Or living in an area that's a lot more fun with a lot more, you know, good restaurants, right, good bars to go to, or closer to friends. So I think those are like kind of some of the things that you have to consider
that's
when you're making
point.
These other.
Your return is non-monetary sometimes.
Exactly. Like, yeah. You're, because people will say, okay, I put $100,000 into an MBA, or I put, you know, that much into my undergraduate degree, and like, I'm not seeing the immediate returns, but did you have a really good time those 2 years or those four years or whatnot? Did you?
Right. What's the return?
Exactly.
On that?
Did you get in better shape? Did you, like, maybe the gym membership isn't worth $100 a month, right, but if you felt yourself going to the gym more and becoming more healthy after the month, I think, like, then that's where, and all these things are all very complex, like, of how you're going to, do you weigh your fitness the most? And that's where you have to set, like, your own personal importance to all these kind of pieces.
That's a great point. I remember my brother came to me, like, a few years ago, and he was so obsessed with investing in stocks and trying to find, like, the next Google or now the next Facebook. And I told him, like, if you just spend that same effort investing in yourself and your career, your returns are going to be way higher than you would get by investing in one of these stocks.
I mean, think about, like, if you spend 2 hours investing, right, like, picking out what stock to invest in, or you spend 2 hours reading a book that's relevant to your,
right,
career or something.
Or networking, or, you know, trying to, you know, socializing with your boss or whatever it takes, you know, for your job.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Or, looking for a new job if that's not what you're interested
absolutely.
In.
Absolutely.
I think that's where it's a lot more valuable.
Right. I think in investing, the best thing to know is what not to do, and that is don't gamble. Don't look for the next, like, rocket. That's the next Google. Just keep calm and, you know, don't rush into anything.
I always felt like individual stocks. I think one of my dad's friends said something like, just invest play money. I mean, it could be a different level. And of course, if you're Warren Buffett, that's not play money because he has way more control. But if you get, like, it's fun to be like, hey, Amazon's doing great and I invested in them and I knew they'd do great, or whatever. Like, Bezos is a genius, so I knew and I invested in them. But, you know, invest something that you're willing to lose, because you never know when there's going to be some giant controversy or a giant accident, or they just are not as smart as you thought they were.
In investing, slow and steady usually wins the race. So if you invest slowly and steadily over periods of time and hold for a long term, you'll probably do okay. You'll probably beat most people.
Yep. Well, hey, I think that's it for this episode. So if you get the chance, please drink up, and also be sure to give us a like and give us a rating on iTunes.
Can we get a Snapchat too?
Yeah.
Let's snap us.
Should we snap each other?
Yeah, let's snap. I want to snap.
Share us on Facebook, wherever you may be able to get us out there. Hopefully you had a good time. We had a good time. Cheers.
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 You wrote to your lover long ago, just a sketch, it said nothing I didn't already know. It brought a bad feeling, it reminded me of me. Broken heart, misunderstood so, and burned out. I say goodbye, I don't intend to say hello for a long, long time. I just roll up into the dark night. Most of all, I try to find my own way. Quite different than yours, but we ended up at the same place. There are some things, no matter how much I try, blood is thicker than water, whiskey or wine. When I say goodbye, don't intend to say hello for a long, long time. I just roll off into the dark night. to say hello for a long, long time. I just roll on.